Chapter 5. Account Overdrawn. It was the first failure in the history of Reardon Steel. For the first time, an order was not delivered as promised. But by February 15th, when the Taggart Rail was due, it made no difference to anyone any longer. Winter had come early, in the last days of November. People said that it was the hardest winter on record, and that no one could be blamed for the unusual severity of the snowstorms. They did not care to remember that there had been a time when snowstorms did not sweep unresisted down unlighted roads and upon the roofs of unheated houses, did not stop the movement of trains, did not leave a wake of corpses counted by the hundreds. The first time that Dannegger Coal was late in delivering fuel to Taggart Transcontinental, in the last week of December, Dannegger's cousin explained that he could not help it. He had had to cut the workday down to 6 hours, he said, in order to raise the morale of the men who did not seem to function as they had in the days of his cousin Kenneth. The men had become listless and sloppy, he said, because they were exhausted by the harsh discipline of the former management. He could not help it if some of the superintendents and foremen had quit him without reason, men who had been with the company for 10 to 20 years. He could not help it if there seemed to be some friction between his workers and his new supervisory staff, even though the new men were much more liberal than the old slave drivers. It was only a matter of readjustment, he said. He could not help it, he said, if the tonnage intended for Taggart Transcontinental had been turned over on the eve of its scheduled delivery to the Bureau of Global Relief for shipment to the People's State of England. It was an emergency. The people of England were starving, with all of their state factories closing down. And Miss Taggart was being unreasonable, since it was only a matter of 1 day's delay. It was only 1 day's delay. It caused a 3 days' delay in the run of freight train number 386, bound from California to New York with 59 carloads of lettuce and oranges. Freight train number 386 waited on sidings, at coaling stations, for the fuel that had not arrived. When the train reached New York, the lettuce and oranges had to be dumped into the East River. They had waited their turn too long in the freight houses of California. With the train schedules cut and the engines forbidden by directive to pull a train of more than 60 cars, nobody but their friends and trade associates noticed that three orange growers in California went out of business, as well as two lettuce farmers in Imperial Valley. Nobody noticed the closing of a commission house in New York, of a plumbing company to which the commission house owed money, of a lead pipe wholesaler who had supplied the plumbing company. When people were starving, said the newspapers, one did not have to feel concern over the failures of business enterprises, which were only private ventures for private profit. The coal shipped across the Atlantic by the Bureau of Global Relief did not reach the People's State of England. It was seized by Ragnar Danishold. The second time that Dannegger Coal was late in delivering fuel to Taggart Transcontinental in mid-January, Danniger's cousin snarled over the telephone that he could not help it. His mines had been shut down for 3 days due to a shortage of lubricating oil for the machinery. The supply of coal to Taggart Transcontinental was 4 days late. Mr. Quinn of the Quinn Ball Bearing Company, which had once moved from Connecticut to Colorado, waited a week for the freight train that carried his order of Reardon steel. When the train arrived, the doors of the Quinn Ball Bearing Company's plant were closed. Nobody traced the closing of a motor company in Michigan that had waited for a shipment of ball bearings, its machinery idle, its workers on full pay, or the closing of a sawmill in Oregon that had waited for a new motor, or the closing of a lumber yard in Iowa left without supply, or the bankruptcy of a building contractor in Illinois, who, failing to get his lumber on time, found his contracts canceled, and the purchasers of his homes sent wandering off down snow-swept roads in search of that which did not exist anywhere any longer. The snowstorm that came at the end of January blocked the passes through the Rocky Mountains, raising white walls 30 feet high across the mainline track of Taggart Transcontinental. The men who attempted to clear the track gave up within the first few hours. The rotary plows broke down one after another. The plows had been kept in precarious repair for 2 years past the span of their usefulness. The new plows had not been delivered. The manufacturer had quit, unable to obtain the steel he needed from Orr and Boyle. Three westbound trains were trapped on the sidings of Winston Station high in the Rockies, where the main line of Taggart Transcontinental cut across the northwest corner of Colorado. For 5 days they remained beyond the reach of help. Trains could not approach them through the storm. The last of the trucks, made by Lawrence Hammond, broke down on the frozen grades of the mountain highways. The best of the airplanes, once made by Dwight Sanders, were sent out, but never reached Winston Station. They were worn past the stage of fighting a storm. Through the driving mesh of snow, the passengers trapped aboard the trains looked out at the lights of Winston's shanties. The lights died in the night of the second day. By the evening of the third, the lights, the heat, and the food had given out aboard the trains. In the brief lulls of the storm, when the white mesh vanished and left behind it the stillness of a black void, merging a lightless earth with a starless sky, the passengers could see, many miles away to the south, a small tongue of flame twisting in the wind. It was Wyatt's torch. By the morning of the sixth day, when the trains were able to move and proceed down the slopes of Utah, of Nevada, of California, the trainmen observed the smokeless stacks and the closed doors of small trackside factories, which had not been closed on their last run. "Storms are an act of God," wrote Bertram Scudder, "and nobody can be held socially responsible for the weather." The rations of coal established by Wesley Mooch permitted the heating of homes for 3 hours a day. There was no wood to burn, no metal to make new stoves, no tools to pierce the walls of the houses for new installations. In makeshift contraptions of bricks and oil cans, professors were burning the books of their libraries, and fruit growers were burning the trees of their orchards. "Privation strengthens a people's spirit," wrote Bertram Scudder, "and forged the fine steel of social discipline. Sacrifice is the cement which unites human bricks into the great edifice of society." The nation which had once held the creed that greatness is achieved by production is now told that it is achieved by squalor, said Francisco D'Anconia in a press interview. But this was not printed. The only business boom that winter came to the amusement industry. People wrenched their pennies out of the quicksands of their food and heat budgets and went without meals in order to crowd into movie theaters, in order to escape for a few hours the state of animals reduced to the single concern of terror over their crudest needs. In January, all movie theaters, nightclubs, and bowling alleys were closed, by order of Wesley Mooch, for the purpose of conserving fuel. "Pleasure is not an essential of existence," wrote Bertram Scudder. "You must learn to take a philosophical attitude," said Dr. Simon Pritchett to a young girl student who broke down into sudden hysterical sobs in the middle of a lecture. She had just returned from a volunteer relief expedition to a settlement on Lake Superior. She had seen a mother holding the body of a grown son who had died of hunger. "There are no absolutes," said Dr. Pritchett. "Reality is only an illusion. How does that woman know that her son is dead? How does she know that he ever existed?" People with pleading eyes and desperate faces crowded into tents where evangelists cried in triumphant gloating that man was unable to cope with nature, that his science was a fraud, that his mind was a failure, that he was reaping punishment for the sin of pride, for his confidence in his own intellect, and that only faith in the power of mystic secrets could protect him from the fissure of a rail or from the blowout of the last tire on his last truck. Love was the key to the mystic secrets, they cried. Love and selfless sacrifice to the needs of others. Orrin Boyle made a selfless sacrifice to the needs of others. He sold to the Bureau of Global Relief for shipment to the People's State of Germany 10,000 tons of structural steel shapes that had been intended for the Atlantic Southern Railroad. "It was a difficult decision to make," he said with a moist, unfocused look of righteousness to the panic-stricken president of the Atlantic Southern. "But I weighed the fact that you are a rich corporation while the people of Germany are in a state of unspeakable misery. So I acted on the principle that need comes first. When in doubt, it's the weak that must be considered, not the strong." The president of the Atlantic Southern had heard that Orrin Boyle's most valuable friend in Washington had a friend in the Ministry of Supply of the People's State of Germany. But whether this had been Boyle's motive, or whether it had been the principle of sacrifice, no one could tell. And it made no difference. If Boyle had been a saint of the creed of selflessness, he would have had to do precisely what he had done. This silenced the president of the Atlantic Southern. He dared not admit that he cared for his railroad more than for the people of Germany. He dared not argue against the principle of sacrifice. The waters of the Mississippi had been rising all through the month of January, swollen by the storms, driven by the wind into a restless grinding of current, and against every obstruction in their way. On a night of lashing sleet, in the first week of February, The Mississippi Bridge of the Atlantic Southern collapsed under a passenger train. The engine and the first five sleepers went down with the cracking girders into the twisting black spirals of water 80 feet below. The rest of the train remained on the first three spans of the bridge, which held. "You can't have your cake and let your neighbor eat it, too," said Francisco D'Anconia. The fury of denunciations which the holders of public voices unleashed against him was greater than their concern over the horror at the river. It was whispered that the chief engineer of the Atlantic Southern, in despair over the company's failure to obtain the steel he needed to reinforce the bridge, had resigned 6 months ago, telling the company that the bridge was unsafe. He had written a letter to the largest newspaper in New York, warning the public about it. The letter had not been printed. It was whispered that the first three spans of the bridge had held, because they had been reinforced with structural shapes of Reardon metal. But 500 tons of the metal was all that the railroad had been able to obtain, under the fair share law. As the sole result of official investigations, two bridges across the Mississippi belonging to smaller railroads were condemned. One of the railroads went out of business. The other closed a branch line, tore up its rail, and laid a track to the Mississippi Bridge of Taggart Transcontinental. So did the Atlantic Southern. The Great Taggart Bridge at Bedford, Illinois, had been built by Nathaniel Taggart. He had fought the government for years because the courts had ruled on the complaint of river shippers that railroads were a destructive competition to shipping and thus a threat to the public welfare, and that railroad bridges across the Mississippi were to be forbidden as a material obstruction. The courts had ordered Nathaniel Taggart to tear down his bridge and to carry his passengers across the river by means of barges. He had won that battle by a majority of one voice on the Supreme Court. His bridge was now the only major link left to hold the continent together. His last descendant had made it her strictest rule that whatever else was neglected, the Taggart Bridge would always be maintained in flawless shape. The steel shipped across the Atlantic by the Bureau of Global Relief had not reached the People's State of Germany. It had been seized by Ragnar Daneschult. But nobody heard of it outside the Bureau, because the newspapers had long since stopped mentioning the activities of Ragnar Daneschult. It was not until the public began to notice the growing shortage, then the disappearance from the market of electric irons, toasters, washing machines, and all electrical appliances, that people began to ask questions and to hear whispers. They heard that no ship loaded with D'Anconia copper was able to reach a port of the United States. It could not get past Ragnar Daneschult. In the foggy winter nights on the waterfront, sailors whispered the story that Ragnar Daneschult always seized the cargoes of relief vessels, but never touched the copper. He sank the D'Anconia ships with their loads. He let the crews escape in lifeboats, but the copper went to the bottom of the ocean. They whispered it as a dark legend beyond men's power to explain. Nobody could find a reason why Daneschult did not choose to take the copper. In the second week of February, for the purpose of conserving copper wire and electric power, a directive forbade the running of elevators above the 25th floor. The upper floors of the buildings had to be vacated, and partitions of unpainted boards went up to cut off the stairways. By special permit, exceptions were granted, on the grounds of essential need, to a few of the larger business enterprises and the more fashionable hotels. The tops of the cities were cut down. The inhabitants of New York had never had to be aware of the weather. Storms had been only a nuisance that slowed the traffic and made puddles in the doorways of brightly lighted shops. Stepping against the wind, dressed in raincoats, furs, and evening slippers, people had felt that a storm was an intruder within the city. Now, facing the gusts of snow that came sweeping down the narrow streets, people felt in dim terror that they were the temporary intruders, and that the wind had the right of way. "It won't make any difference to us now. Forget it, Hank. It doesn't matter," said Dagny, when Reardon told her that he would not be able to deliver the rail. He had not been able to find a supplier of copper. "Forget it, Hank." He did not answer her. He could not forget the first failure of Reardon's steel. On the evening of February 15th, a plate cracked on a rail joint and sent an engine off the track half a mile from Winston, Colorado, on a division which was to have been relayed with the new rail. The station agent of Winston sighed and sent for a crew with a crane. It was only one of the minor accidents that were happening in his section every other day or so. He was getting used to it. Reardon that evening, his coat collar raised, his hat slanted low over his eyes, the snowdrifts rising to his knees, was tramping through an abandoned open-pit coal mine in a forsaken corner of Pennsylvania, supervising the loading of pirated coal upon the trucks which he had provided. Nobody owned the mine. Nobody could afford the cost of working it. But a young man with a brusque voice and dark, angry eyes, who came from a starving settlement, had organized a gang of the unemployed and made a deal with Reardon to deliver the coal. They mined it at night. They stored it in hidden culverts. They were paid in cash, with no questions asked or answered. Guilty of a fierce desire to remain alive, they and Reardon traded like savages, without rights, titles, contracts, or protection, with nothing but mutual understanding and a ruthlessly absolute observance of one's given word. Reardon did not even know the name of the young leader. Watching him at the job of loading the trucks, Reardon thought that this boy, if born a generation earlier, would have become a great industrialist. Now he would probably end his brief life as a plain criminal in a few more years. Dagny, that evening, was facing a meeting of the Taggart Board of Directors. They sat about a polished table in a stately boardroom which was inadequately heated. The men who, through the decades of their careers, had relied for their security upon keeping their faces blank, their words inconclusive, and their clothes impeccable, were thrown off key by the sweaters stretched over their stomachs, by the mufflers wound about their necks, by the sound of coughing that cut through the discussion too frequently, like the rattle of a machine gun. She noted that Jim had lost the smoothness of his usual performance. He sat with his head drawn into his shoulders, and his eyes kept darting too rapidly from face to face. A man from Washington sat at the table among them. Nobody knew his exact job or title, but it was not necessary. They knew that he was the man from Washington. His name was Mr. Weatherby. He had graying temples, a long, narrow face, and a mouth that looked as if he had to stretch his facial muscles in order to keep it closed. This gave a suggestion of primness to a face that displayed nothing else. The directors did not know whether he was present as the guest, the advisor, or the ruler of the board. They preferred not to find out. "It seems to me," said the chairman, "that the top problem for us to consider is the fact that the track of our main line appears to be in a deplorable, not to say critical, condition." He paused, then added cautiously, "While the only good rail we own is that of the John Galt, the Rio Norte line." In the same cautious tone of waiting for someone else to pick up the intended purpose of his words, another man said, "If we consider our critical shortage of equipment, and if we consider that we are letting it wear out in the service of a branch line running at a loss..." He stopped and did not state what would occur if they considered it. "In my opinion," said a thin, pallid man with a neat mustache, "the Rio Norte line seems to have become a financial burden which the company might not be able to carry. That is, not unless certain readjustments are made, which..." He did not finish, but glanced at Mr. Weatherby. Mr. Weatherby looked as if he had not noticed it. "Jim," said the chairman, "I think you might explain the picture to Mr. Weatherby." Taggart's voice still retained a practiced smoothness, but it was the smoothness of a piece of cloth stretched tight over a broken glass object, and the sharp edges showed through once in a while. "I think it is generally conceded that the main factor affecting every railroad in the country is the unusual rate of business failures. Why, we all realize, of course, that this is only temporary still, for the moment. It has made the railroad situation approach a stage that may well be described as desperate. Specifically, the number of factories which have closed throughout the territory of the Taggart Transcontinental System is so large that it has wrecked our entire financial structure. Districts and divisions, which had always brought us our steadiest revenues, are now showing an actual operating loss. A train schedule geared to a heavy volume of freight cannot be maintained for three shippers, where once there had been seven. We cannot give them the same service, at least not at our present rates." He glanced at Mr. Weatherby, but Mr. Weatherby did not seem to notice. "It seems to me," said Taggart, the sharp edges becoming sharper in his voice, "that the stand taken by our shippers is unfair. Most of them have been complaining about their competitors and have passed various local measures to eliminate competition in their particular fields. Now, most of them are practically in sole possession of their markets, yet they refuse to realize that a railroad cannot give to one lone factory the freight rates which had been made possible by the production of a whole region. We are running our trains for them at a loss, yet they have taken a stand against any raise in rates.
Against any raise? Said Mr. Weatherby mildly, with a good imitation of astonishment. That is not the stand they have taken.
If certain rumors which I refuse to credit are true, said the chairman, and stopped one syllable after the tone of panic had become obvious in his voice.
Jim, said Mr. Weatherby pleasantly, I think it would be best if we just didn't mention the subject of raising the rates.
I wasn't suggesting an actual raise at this time, said Taggart hastily. I merely referred to it to round out the picture.
But, Jim, said an old man with a quavering voice, I thought that your influence, I mean your friendship, with Mr. Mooch would ensure—
He stopped because the others were looking at him severely, in reproof for the breach of an unwritten law. One did not mention a failure of this kind. One did not discuss the mysterious ways of Jim's powerful friendships, or why they had failed him.
Fact is, said Mr. Weatherby easily, that Mr. Mooch sent me here to discuss the demand of the railway unions for a raise in wages, and the demand of the shippers for a cut in rates.
He said it in a tone of casual firmness. He knew that all these men had known it, that the demands had been discussed in the newspapers for months. He knew that the dread in these men's minds was not of the fact, but of his naming it, as if the fact had not existed, but his words held the power to make it exist. He knew that they had waited to see whether he would exercise that power. He was letting them know that he would. Their situation warranted an outcry of protest. There was none. Nobody answered him. Then James Taggart said, in that biting, nervous tone which is intended to convey anger, but merely confesses uncertainty, I wouldn't exaggerate the importance of Buzzy Watts of the National Shippers Council. He's been making a lot of noise and giving a lot of expensive dinners in Washington, but I wouldn't advise taking it too seriously.
Oh, I don't know, said Mr. Weatherby.
Listen, Clem, I do know that Wesley refused to see him last week.
That's true. Wesley is a pretty busy man.
And I know that when Gene Lawson gave that big party 10 days ago, practically everybody was there, but Buzzy Watts was not invited.
That's so, said Mr. Weatherby peaceably.
So I wouldn't bet on Mr. Buzzy Watts, Clem, and I wouldn't let it worry me.
Wesley's an impartial man, said Mr. Weatherby, a man devoted to public duty. It's the interests of the country as a whole that he's got to consider above everything else.
Taggart sat up. Of all of the danger signs he knew, this line of talk was the worst.
Nobody can deny it, Jim, that Wesley feels a high regard for you as an enlightened businessman, a valuable adviser, and one of his closest personal friends.
Taggart's eyes shot to him swiftly. This was still worse.
But nobody can say that Wesley would hesitate to sacrifice his personal feelings and friendships where the welfare of the public is concerned.
Taggart's face remained blank. His terror came from things never allowed to reach expression in words or in facial muscles. The terror was his struggle against an unadmitted thought. He himself had been the public for so long and in so many different issues that he knew what it would mean if that magic title, that sacred title no one dared to oppose, were transferred along with its welfare to the person of Buzzy Watts. But what he asked, and he asked it hastily, was,
You're not implying that I would place my personal interests above the public welfare, are you?
No, of course not, said Mr. Weatherby, with a look that was almost a smile. Certainly not, not you, Jim. Your public-spirited attitude and understanding are too well known. That's why Wesley expects you to see every side of the picture.
Yes, of course, said Taggart, trapped.
Well, consider the union side of it. Maybe you can't afford to give them a raise, but how can they afford to exist when the cost of living is shot sky high? They've got to eat, don't they? That comes first, railroad or no railroad. Mr. Weatherby's tone had a kind of placid righteousness, as if he were reciting a formula required to convey another meaning clear to all of them. He was looking straight at Taggart, in special emphasis of the unstated.
There are almost 1 million members in the railway unions, with families, dependents, and poor relatives, and who hasn't got poor relatives these days? It amounts to about 5 million votes. Persons, I mean. Wesley has to bear that in mind. He has to think of their psychology, and then consider the public. The rates you're charging were established at a time when everybody was making money, but the way things are now, the cost of transportation has become a burden nobody can afford. People are screaming about it all over the country.
He looked straight at Taggart. He merely looked, but his glance had the quality of a wink.
There's an awful lot of them, Jim. They're not very happy at the moment about an awful lot of things. A government that would bring the railroad rates down would make a lot of folks grateful.
The silence that answered him was like a hole so deep that no sound could be heard of the things crashing down to its bottom. Taggart knew, as they all knew, to what disinterested motive Mr. Mooch would always be ready to sacrifice his personal friendships. It was the silence, and the fact that she did not want to say it, had come here resolved not to speak, but could not resist it, that made Dagny's voice sound so vibrantly harsh.
Got what you've been asking for all these years, gentlemen?
The swiftness with which their eyes moved to her was an involuntary answer to an unexpected sound. But the swiftness with which they moved away, to look down at the table, at the walls, anywhere but at her, was the conscious answer to the meaning of the sounds. In the silence of the next moment, she felt their resentment, like a starch, thickening the air of the room, and she knew that it was not resentment against Mr. Weatherby, but against her. She could have borne it, if they had merely let her question go unanswered. But what made her feel a sickening tightness in her stomach was their double fraud of pretending to ignore her, and then answering in their own kind of manner. The chairman said, not looking at her, his voice pointedly noncommittal, yet vaguely purposeful at the same time. It would have been all right. Everything would have worked out fine if it weren't for the wrong people in positions of power, such as Buzzy Watts and Chick Morrison.
Oh, I wouldn't worry about Chick Morrison, said the pallid man with the mustache. He hasn't any top-level connections, not really. It's Tinky Holloway that's poison.
I don't see the picture as hopeless, said a portly man who wore a green muffler. Joe Dunphy and Bud Hazelton are very close to Wesley. If their influence prevails, we'll be all right. However, Kip Chalmers and Tinky Holloway are dangerous.
I can take care of Kip Chalmers, said Taggart.
Mr. Weatherby was the only person in the room who did not mind looking at Dagny, but whenever his glance rested upon her, it registered nothing. She was the only person in the room who he did not see.
I am thinking, said Mr. Weatherby casually, looking at Taggart, that you might do Wesley a favor.
Wesley knows that he can always count on me.
Well, my thought is that if you granted the union's wage raises, we might drop the question of cutting the rates for the time being.
I can't do that!
It was almost a cry. The National Alliance of Railroads has taken a unanimous stand against the raises, and has committed every member to refuse.
That's just what I mean, said Mr. Weatherby softly. Wesley needs to drive a wedge into that alliance stand. If a railroad like Taggart Transcontinental were to give in, the rest would be easy. You would help Wesley a great deal. He would appreciate it.
But good God, Clem, I'd be open to court action for it by the alliance rules.
Mr. Weatherby smiled.
What court? Let Wesley take care of that.
But listen, Clem, you know just as well as I do that we can't afford it.
Mr. Weatherby shrugged.
That's a problem for you to work out.
How, for Christ's sake?
I don't know. That's your job, not ours. You wouldn't want the government to start telling you how to run your railroad, would you?
No, of course not, but
our job is only to see that the people get fair wages and decent transportation. It's up to you to deliver.
But, of course, if you say that you can't do the job,
why then—
I haven't said it, Taggart cried hastily. I haven't said it at all.
Good, said Mr. Weatherby pleasantly. We know that you have the ability to find some way to do it.
He was looking at Taggart. Taggart was looking at Dagny.
Well, it was just a thought, said Mr. Weatherby, leaning back in his chair in a manner of modest withdrawal.
Just a thought for you to mull over. I'm only a guest here. I don't want to interfere. The purpose of the meeting was to discuss the situation of the branch lines, I believe.
Yes, said the chairman, and sighed.
Yes. Now, if anyone has a constructive suggestion to offer...
He waited. No one answered.
I believe the picture is clear to all of us.
He waited.